You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. As the world hangs in the balance, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I know cutting-edge radio when I hear it. I'm going to play you part of the Beyond Zero Emissions radio show on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. Following discussion of the Climate Action March in Melbourne, November 27th, host Vivian Langford starts in-depth with David Spratt, co-author of the book Climate Code Red, and host of the influential blog of the same name. Then you'll hear from Dr. Colin Long, leader in the National Tertiary Education Union, and he champions workers in the transition away from carbon. Vivian's third guest is psychologist Lynn Bender from the group Psychology for a Safe Climate. The group starts off talking about the climate movement in Melbourne, which I find exciting, but trust me, it's not long before they dive into issues that affect us all. Here is Vivian Langford.
Okay, David Spratt's with us. And look, David Spratt's someone I admire. He's been a catalyst for getting real on climate for a decade. Me with my delusions, I always find them quite quickly dispelled when I go to one of his talks. And since Climate Code Red, he has published reports and given hundreds of talks on bright siding and why it's a bad strategy to always tell the positive story, permafrost, bubbling our way to the apocalypse. And he explains why there's no carbon budget left, really, and why 2 degrees is far too high. We shouldn't be even contemplating that. So welcome, David.
Thanks for the cheery intro.
Well, tell us about the diversity of groups mobilising around the Paris Climate Conference.
Well, look, the People's Climate March in Melbourne is coming Friday at 5:30 at the State Library. Is really in part an attempt by the climate movement to build more strength, more power. And in that, I think it's done well because we've got a whole lot of people signed up who we haven't seen before, who haven't been active before. One of the really exciting things is that faith groups have really come on board, and just yesterday, 8 faith umbrella groups in Victoria. So this is not individual churches, but umbrella bodies such as the Council of Churches, the Jewish Community Council, the Islamic Society, the umbrella bodies for Hindus, for Buddhists and so on, all signed on to a statement together. And this is unprecedented in Victoria. And I'll just read a couple of sentences because I think it really shows how it's changing and their commitment. And they say in this statement, "We stand together in our moral obligation to care for sacred earth, the most vulnerable people and all human life as a gift entrusted to our common care as we are confronted by the growing impacts of climate change in all corners of the world. More extreme weather events disrupt food production and water security," what Colin was just talking about in relationship to Syria. "Exacerbate hunger, cause economic insecurity and forced displacement." Syria again. "We share a common concern for nature and for global social justice and are deeply concerned that climate change is a threat to precious human life and to the survival of humanity unless strong and urgent action is taken to address the causes." And that's just one of the sectors that's come on board. So I think just let's give a sense that this is not the same old suspects of just a few greenie and climate groups. We've got unions, no. We've got these, we've got health workers, we've got bike riders riding in from Moreland and from Ceres. It's really going to be a very diverse and exciting event.
And we've always been talking about building the movement, and George Marshall came out here, I think, with the Psychologist for a Safe Climate, and he talked about talking to diverse people and how each little community has its own leaders who can talk to them in their own language. And so people who are coming from the Sikh community, for example, might have a sort of a Sikh sort of world view that their leaders can appeal to.
I can't get Catholic high school populations to come to the march, but the Pope and Catholic Earth Care and this statement and having a Catholic cardinal visiting from Honduras speak at the march can. And we know that messages work better when you trust and are familiar with the people who are giving you those messages, and that's why this diversity in organisation is important.
Well, David, can I just ask you, how can it be that all these groups that probably have huge amounts of things in conflict between themselves and within their groups, you know, ideological differences, they can all just write this statement that you've read out and agree on something such as, quote, a just transition to clean energy. How can they all be suddenly all on behalf of clean energy?
Look, the ideological schisms between various faiths would require several PhDs and many of Collins' colleagues to unravel, but there is common cause. They were having a discussion about what their interfaith banner should say, and the words care for sacred earth was something they could all sign off on. Now, the word care is really prominent in the Pope's encyclical, but care for sacred earth was something that all of them said, we agree with this. So, I mean, all these processes of bringing people together despite their differences is about finding common cause, common language and common action, and I hope that's what we'll do on Friday.
So consider yourself very royally invited, listener, from faith group, union group, green groups. You don't have to be from any one of those. You can just be a citizen who's been thinking about this a lot, and you'll find, as Lynn said, some comfort in joining together with, I think, a very impressive big rally. It'll be one of those big ones.
Can I just give one very simple example? So there's a whole lot of feed-in events before the main rally.
Okay.
Bike riders coming from Moreland, from the mechanics at 4:30, coming from Ceres at 4:45. The unions, as Colin said, are marching down from Trades Hall. And the faith groups are having a little thing called a farewell to coal. With a coffin and a choir and all sorts of little things around the corner from the main march at Wesley Church at 148 Lonsdale Street from 5 o'clock on Friday. And they will all gather there, and various interfaith speakers will go through a set of words to say some things about coal, what our Pacific leaders have been saying. So all those leading events are on the website at peoplesclimate.com.au/Melbourne, and you'll see all these leading events listed if you want to join whatever is appropriate for you.
You seem to be getting quite excited about it. Look, for a veteran person of many progressive movements, and I know Lynn is too, how do you think the sheer numbers of this big march here and worldwide, and knowing that they're part of something that is worldwide, will change the people who attend? It just can't end with this one rally. It has to have some effect on those people to motivate them, activate them, let's say.
Look, I think when people go to really big events, there is a certain spirit or power that often is part of that event, and you feel special. There's all these other people there who agree with you. It's exciting. There's a real diversity in messages and people, and you're being part of something big and knowing you're strong in numbers is one of the most empowering things you can do, and one of the most disempowering things you can do, as Lynn will tell you, is to sit alone at home and do social media for 5 hours a night. I mean, we live in a world of breaking down of collectivities, of individualism and selfies and so on. So this may be, you know, the anti-selfie rally, where we don't take photos of ourselves, but we take photos of really large groups of people making common cause.
Well, so Lynn, can I ask you, in terms of, you know, we have George Brandis putting again in front of Parliament the thing that calls, who tells people who take their very legitimate cause to not have a coal mine in their backyard to court, sort of vigilante litigation, like a huge oxymoron, green terrorists and so on. People are being vilified. There's a certain little closet group, I hope it's only a small group, within the Conservative ranks who really hate what we're doing. They think this is, you know, some communist plot that is going to ruin all the projects of capitalism.
Well,
this rally included.
Well, they're protecting what they perceive to be their interests. But James Hansen, who's, I would call, quite a conservative scientist, got arrested over the tar sands. So did Mark Jacquard, who doesn't like me calling him conservative. I checked that I'd got his checklist right, which I had, but he didn't like conservative, so I had to take it out. But they're people who have been part of the establishment, if you like, that they haven't gone against the flow. They're not, you know, just objecting people for objecting's sake. So has Bill McKibben become a protester and activist? And using the law is totally appropriate. The law's there to safeguard the community and people's rights and the world, in fact. So to rail against the use of the law is absurd. I think it's quite worrying, because it's a tendency towards Now, can I say this? This is me. This is not 3CR. It's a tendency towards fascism when you take control of the state.
I'm sure that's been said on this station before now.
And you make laws about things that, get in the way of your power. And so I would think it's quite outrageous. I think anyone should take it as a great honour to be called an echo, to find George Brandis criticising them for taking action. I think it's responsible. That's why I think we all should go to this march, because we're saying we're going to stand up and be counted. We're telling our children why we're doing it. I'm telling people no appointments this Friday because I'm going to the march.
Good on you. Okay, look, David, I want to come back now to the hard stuff about Paris. These pledges that the nations have all put on the table, they will lead to a 3-degree plus warming. You know, Mark Wasdell calculates they lead to about 7 degrees of warming. I don't want to quibble about how much warming. It's all far too much. So we need some rigorous thinking. And can you give me, like, short answers, David, on this? Just yes or not even yes or no, but just quick answers, would you mind? Because I know you know this, like, very, very well. Can you just say, do we have enough scientific information for an emergency response?
Yes.
Do we need consensus among the nations to generate that response?
If you wait for consensus, you may wait a long time. What you need is leadership from countries and people who count.
What would an emergency response look like if there is no carbon budget left?
It would mean planning a really rapid transition. I think the first thing is you just cannot leave it to the market. John Schellenhuber, who's head of the Potsdam Institute in Germany and the advisor of the EU and Angela Merkel, the leading climate scientist advocate in Europe, says what we need is, and these are wonderful words, a controlled implosion of the fossil fuel industry. And that is something that's not going to happen by accident by the market. It has to be planned and organised. And as Colin's talked about, we have to think about the Labor Party and the investment funds and the new industries and have a way of doing that. And it's not difficult. It's saying no new fossil fuel industry to start with. Stop the subsidies, the up to $10 billion a year that Australia's putting into fossil fuels. Plan this controlled implosion and a just transition and new jobs and different industries. Build the new with that money we've liberated, and then sort out the problems that remain after that. I mean, these are concrete things that can be done if government intervenes and plans, because all rapid changes in society have been brought about by conscious collective social action, whether it be the Marshall Plan or the Japanese or Chinese transitions. These require collective social plan and will.
Okay. How can we go back below the 1 degree of warming that we've caused so far, if not beyond zero?
We have to stop emitting fossil fuels, and then we have to get rid of the extra stuff we put up there. Now, we know some ways to do that are limited in extent. We know that reforestation will draw it down. We know over long periods of time the ocean will take it down. We have to find the ways to get really large amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And we don't know them all now. Terrible analogy, when they set out to build the atom bomb, they had no idea how to build one. But if you do the work, you'll find the answers. And this is one of those things where, and Schellenhuber says, research, 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 as well as stopping fossil fuels. And if you do enough of this work, we will get the answers.
Okay. Thinking about the Indonesian peat fires and the melting permafrost, which is a subject I never knew about permafrost until I read Climate Code Red, and that was the thing that I really took from your book. Permafrost, my gosh, when that starts melting and the methane comes out, we're really game over. So thinking about that, we've just seen it in Indonesia. Why are these climate changes not up for discussion at Paris?
Because the international political policy-making process is consciously delusional. It is not setting out to solve the problem. It does not start by recognising the science as it really is, not recognising the problem that it really is. You cannot produce an answer without elaborating the question honestly, and they are not elaborating the question. They talk about carbon budgets being left when there's none. They talk about 2 degrees as being a reasonable target when James Hansen says it's a quote-unquote a recipe for disaster. So if you're not honest about the problem, you'll never get the answer, and that's what policymakers are doing because they do not want to rock the boat. Garnaut and Stern and all these people have said, we should do these things, but it'd be too disruptive to the market, so let's do less. And is this notion that we cannot do anything that's economically disruptive that stops the policymaking process from having an honest grip with reality, as opposed to Sheldon Hooper, who says we need a controlled implosion. That has a particular economic resonance. It means, sorry, it's not win-win. These industries simply have to go. And we've seen that renewable energy has been incredibly economic disruptive. I mean, in Germany, the large electricity companies have no share market value anymore. The six large companies, because they've been disrupted by this new technology. So we have to accept there'll be disruption and radical change. And that's what they can't or won't do in Paris.
Right. Colin, do you have anything to put in there?
Yes, very. I agree with everything that's been said. I think a very helpful analogy is to suggest that, in the 1930s, there were British arms manufacturers selling weaponry to Germany, and it would be like saying after the invasion of Poland by the Nazis that the British government would say to the British arms manufacturers, oh well, we won't interfere with your trade in weaponry to Germany. We don't want to interfere in the market for that. We should just see how the market lets it determine whether you should sell weaponry to the Germans or not. I mean, we just didn't do that. We just said, stop it. You're not doing it anymore. And the scale of problem we're facing is something that requires something akin to a wartime mobilisation and the sort of planning that took place to enable the Allies to defeat the Nazis in the Second World War. You don't leave it up to the market to just see, oh, it might go here, it might go there. And that is the fundamental problem. I think Naomi Klein discusses this very well in This Changes Everything when she says, unfortunately, the real impact of climate change has started to become obvious to everyone over the last 30 years, precisely at the same time as neoliberalism took over the global political economy. And we can't deal with climate change while governments are under the thrall of neoliberalism and will let the market make all determinations. And that's why I actually go back to something that Lynn said a little earlier, which I slightly disagree with, which is I don't think politicians are often, they're not actually lying about things. They're actually, they just categorically refuse to do anything that interferes in the operation of the market. That's certainly the case in Australia, and that's why, in the end, people will be disappointed by Turnbull, because Turnbull is a market fundamentalist. Abbott was a market fundamentalist. They'll get around to defending the market from different ways, where Abbott was much more disagreeable and aggressive. Turnbull is just a smooth-talking market fundamentalist, but they're in the end, they will both defend the market over the climate. And that's the fundamental problem that we have to deal with at a global level.
Yeah, look, I think that's exactly right. And the political process is always one of compromise.
Yeah.
It's always, there's A or there's B, so we'll find a bit of space in the middle. It's never saying A is absolutely necessary. And, I mean, many years ago I said, it's if these politicians think that you can negotiate with the laws of physics and chemistry. And you can't. This is the one thing when you cannot negotiate with them. They'll just roll over you with heat waves and record or El Ninos, and this year being the hottest year on record. And there's no negotiating with those laws of physics and chemistry. And that's the political disjuncture that you have in Paris.
I guess I agree with everything you're both saying, but I do think they're lying, Colin. I think they're lying by pretending that they're not putting the climate last, which is what they're doing. And they're going there with so-called climate policies that are going to do really well. And, you know, the direct action auction was a stunning success. Yeah. I call that a lie.
Yeah, sure.
And that they, you know, their concern in negotiating at the OECD is climate. No, it's coal. It's business. It's their backside, so to speak. Now, I call that a lie, and yes. I guess the big lie is that you can have an economy without an earth.
Yes.
And the big, it sort of reminds me of a guy who's had a very bad heart attack. He's being wheeled into hospital. He says, I can't go to hospital. I have to go to a meeting. It's a very important meeting at the office. And, you know, of course, he's going to be dead if he doesn't go and have some treatment. So there is no economy without climate action. There is a better economy if we protect the planet as best we can. That's the truth.
Okay, well, I have one last question. We're nearly out of time, and I think David has to leave soon. But the next, I think we're talking about a global issue. We're talking about lack of really global leadership because all those leaders are national leaders. But there's a huge discrepancy between the poorer countries who are suffering the, you know, Typhoon Haiyan, the great floods and heat waves in Pakistan, and any one of us in this room could name the terrible things that are happening. I was in Timor earlier this year and I met the minister, and he said he was going to Paris just to claim loss and damage, you know, and this Green Fund will have to be paying for loss and damage to people who, and certainly to Pacific Islands. Now, Colin, I know you have some expertise. You're, in fact, a historian of the Asia-Pacific. So could you tell us just something from your experience to bring it to life, that what it's like in those countries and how we can back them up in their arguing position at Paris, but also how we can then, as Naomi Klein says, have a Marshall Plan for the Earth where we make a massive transfer of expertise, like your trade union expertise and financing, to the poorer countries.
Yeah, that's a massive... A massive question. You know, I've been doing quite a bit of work around garment workers' rights in Bangladesh. So, you know, we're trying to defend to encourage the organisation of garment workers in Bangladeshi factories, and that's a tough job. I mean, garment workers and their unions members get killed over there if they try and get organised. It's that bad.
Mm.
But, you know, it also occurs to me that we could be achieving all sorts of great things for Bangladeshi garment workers, but it is one of the most vulnerable countries in the world to climate change and sea level rise, and they could lose it all just from the impact of climate change. So they really need, you know, those struggles need to either be in parallel, or the climate change one almost needs to be more important in some ways. So one of the problems, of course, with the Pacific and with Asia is that, you know, the malign influence, or the legacy of colonialism. So there's not a great deal of trust in the West in many ways, and, you know, it's justified. We're still trying to extract as much as we can out of the Asia-Pacific. When I say we, most of the rest of the developed world. And then we have the other added problem of the growth of China, and the very dirty growth of China. There is, you know, talk about how they're trying to introduce more renewable energy and cut back on coal, but it's still a long way to go. But then on the other hand, China and other poor countries do have a claim to try and improve the standards, the living standards of their populations. And fundamentally, I think what it comes down to, yes, we need to transfer wealth, we need to transfer expertise, although you'll be surprised at the expertise that is available in many developing countries already. But fundamentally, what we need to do in the rich world is say, we have too much. We can't continue to grow our economies and pollute in the ways we're doing, because some of these poorer countries need to grow their economies, and they will pump out some CO2 in the process of that to try and improve the living conditions for their people. But we can't continue to do that in the rich West. In fact, we have to decelerate very rapidly.
Mm, that's a nice word, decelerate. I would like to put us all on carbon rations, but...
I'd like a controlled implosion.
What about you, Lynn?
I want people to get the true diagnosis, face the truth, and take action as much as they can on an individual level, not leave it to others. Some of my friends, colleagues have said, oh, you're still busy with that climate march, as though it's sort of a little hobby of mine. I try not to flog it too much because I'll have no friends in the end. But the reality is that we aren't taking responsibility, individual responsibility, not in the sense that it's all our fault, but we're now responsible to do what we can. That's what we're responsible for.
Yes, well, our children and our grandchildren will ask us one day, what did you do in the great struggle against climate change? And we want to be able to say, well, we did something and we stopped it.
I don't think that's good enough. I don't care about what they say. I really don't care about that. That's sort of, what did you do in the war, Daddy, that idea. It's so much bigger than that, Colin, I think. I don't really agree with that.
Well, but it may be that even the top end of town may come to understand that their heirs and descendants won't have a place in a hotter world either.
Mm. Well, as a woman and a mother and a grandmother, it has a lot of, it motivates me greatly when I feel despair and like giving up, because I look at my grandchildren who trust me. I look at my grandchildren who I hope will have a good life. I look at my children and hope they'll get to live to be 68 like me and, you know, be living in a thriving world. I feel immense horror and sadness about their future, and I think we need to, that's the way we conceptualise the future, that's the way we conceptualise caring about the future. And it's our, you know, on a selfish level, it's always been our feeling of contributing to the future, making our lives have a point to them, not just as consumers and people who are left behind garbage and pollution.
Okay, well, I'm getting the sign off now. Thank you very much. That's been a marvellous discussion, I think. I hope the listeners, you've enjoyed it. Just to tell you again, the Climate March starts at 5:30 next Friday, the 27th of November. You can meet at the State Library in Swanson Street and bring your friends. If you can hook up with your union or your faith group, please check out their websites, because they'll be perhaps carrying banners or wearing special colours. I know the faith group are, you know, wearing all purple. If you need any more details, look it up on the internet on the peoplesclimate.org.au/Melbourne. That's for the Melbourne people. For the Australia-wide audience, there are marches in other cities. You just need to look up peoplesclimate.org.au. And we are joining with people worldwide to do this. And I thank our guests, David Spratt, Lynn Bender, and Dr. Colin Long, for giving us their hour of passion and telling us all about it, so that you will come along to the rally at least. But don't just come to the rally. Come prepared to activate yourself for the long haul, because I think it's more than our children and our grandchildren. I think it's really future species and the future of everything. So please come along. Thanks today to the radio team, myself, Vivian Langford, my colleague Jane on the panel, Teddy, Jody, Roger, Miwa and Glenn. And join us next week, Monday at 5:30. Maybe we'll have some guests from Paris.
Radio EcoShock.
There you have it. Lively climate radio from Beyond Zero Emissions, broadcast on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. 3CR also broadcasts Radio EcoShock as one of our international partners. Hello to all our listeners there. Get links to Beyond Zero Emissions in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.